This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. On today's program, we hear from Aussie startups caught up in the collapse of a US bank.
The advice was going from, hey, get maybe some money out, to like, get it all out. Don't be a company that loses its money.
And how artificial intelligence could help improve access to healthcare in regional areas.
Fundamentally, I don't think it's going to replace a human. I think that it means that the process of interpreting the images will be more consistent and probably more reliable.
The federal government's inching closer to a deal with the Coalition to pass one of the key bills required to run this year's referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament. The Coalition's been unhappy with a number of the government's proposals, like going without an official yes and no campaign. But the two major parties were in talks until late last night, with signs the Coalition will drop many of its concerns and back the bill. Here's political reporter Tom Lowry.
It's been a long time between referendums.
I thank every Australian who voted yes. The Republic will come back.
That was Malcolm Turnbull, one of the leaders of the Yes campaign during the 1999 Republic referendum, speaking on the night it was defeated. Later this year, the country will embark on its first referendum in more than two decades. And federal parliament has been weighing up just what it will look like and what needs to change after so much time. It hasn't been without some controversy.
I hope the government will listen to the concerns that have been put forward.
Liberal frontbencher Anne Rustin speaking in the Senate last night.
And I asked them, for the sake of the integrity of this place, for the sake of the integrity of our referendum process, please make sure that you provide a fair and balanced approach.
For months, the Coalition has been pushing for three main changes to legislation outlining how the referendum will be conducted. They pushed for official yes and no campaigns to be established, for funding to be provided to both of those campaigns, and for a pamphlet to be distributed outlining both sides. Here's Senator Linda Reynolds during debate on the bill.
Why are we advocating for an official yes and no campaign? We're doing that simply because it will clearly increase the trust and integrity of the Australian voters in the process itself, which is absolutely critically important.
But as of late last night, the Coalition appeared set to drop that demand, and the funding demand too. The government had previously agreed to a pamphlet, and negotiations on just what it will look like and how it will be put together have been ongoing. There's a quiet confidence on both sides that the bill will pass today, with the Coalition's support. Here's Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg.
I think it makes sense for the major parties of government to agree on the way in which public votes and elections should be conducted. I think that gives confidence to the people of Australia that the major organisations in Australia, at least in a political sense, can agree.
Some in the government have been keen to point out that the bill could have passed without the Coalition, but a deliberate effort was made to accommodate the opposition's views to try and reach a bipartisan position. Senator Bragg, who has long backed an Indigenous voice to Parliament, argues the government could be doing more to bring the Coalition with it. That includes delaying introducing a bill to Parliament, which includes the proposed question and amendment to the Constitution, until after a parliamentary inquiry is held.
We recognise that there is a very broad base of support that is required to pass referenda. And that means people who vote for the Labor Party, people who vote for the Liberal Party, to come together and vote in favour of this change. And so we need to maximise space for there to be that cross-partisan support.
The referendum working group, made up of representatives of First Nations communities from across the country, will hold what is likely to be its final meeting today, settling its advice to the government on both the question and the amendment.
Tom Lowry reporting there, and the ABC requested an interview with the Special Minister of State, Don Farrell, but he was unavailable. In the United States, the latest chapter is unfolding in a court case against Fox News, which is being accused of spreading lies about the last presidential election. The voting machine company, Dominion Voting Systems, is suing the cable TV network and its parent company, Fox Corporation, for defamation. At a hearing in the US state of Delaware today, the Fox News coverage following Donald Trump's 2020 election defeat is being picked apart. North America correspondent Barbara Miller is there. Barb, take us through what's happening there today.
Today, what's known as a summary judgment hearing is taking place. Essentially, both sides in this case, so that's Fox and Dominion voting systems have asked the judge to rule on the case without it going to trial. So they're arguing that it is clearly defamation in the case of Dominion, or clearly not defamation in the case of Fox, so there's no need for a trial and that the judge should simply rule in their favour. If he doesn't do that, this case will proceed to trial. That would be beginning on April the 17th, so about a month's time. That's unless the parties were to settle in that short amount of time between this hearing today and that expected trial date.
What are the arguments that Dominion is putting forward?
Dominion says that Fox, in the weeks following the 2020 elections, knowingly publicised and endorsed claims about Dominion voting systems helping to rig the election in favour of Joe Biden. It said it did that even though the network knew that those claims were false. In particular, they're talking about repeated appearances on the Fox News network by the Trump-affiliated lawyer Sidney Powell and by Rudy Giuliani. So one Dominion lawyer told the court that Fox, because it was worried about ratings, because it was worried that viewers would drift off to more far-right networks or to far-right networks which were publicizing these claims, the lawyer said that Fox let loose the hosts, unleashed the Kraken. And he said this was a deliberate decision because they were worried about ratings. And he said it went all the way up the chain of the command, all the way as far as Rupert Murdoch, who could have and should have intervened.
And how has Fox responded?
They say that they don't claim to have absolute privilege under First Amendment rights to say whatever they want to say. They say what they presented, the reasonable viewer would have looked at that and would have understood that they were allegations and not statements of fact. And they said the facts were that people were making these claims, including the president. And earlier, this was actually in Dominion's case, we saw an excerpt from a deposition from Rupert Murdoch. He said the president of the United States was making wild claims, but that is news. We report the news. So some fairly detailed arguments on defamation law taking place there, as you'd expect. And we don't know quite yet when we'll hear from this judge as to whether he will make that summary judgment or move forward to trial.
Barbara Miller reporting. The presidents of China and Russia have signed a joint statement on strategic cooperation after wrapping up their talks in Moscow. President Vladimir Putin says trade and economic cooperation is a priority for the relationship. But there appears to have been little movement on President Xi Jinping's so-called peace plan for Ukraine, as Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
As the gold doors inside the Grand Kremlin Palace were flung open, the band struck up. And there were salutes all round as President Xi and President Putin strolled down the red carpet. Dressed in matching suits and red ties, they walked towards each other before shaking hands once more. After the ceremony and their talks, both leaders were keen to stress the deepening economic relationship between the two countries. We've just discussed it. It's a good project, a new pipeline, Power of Siberia 2, through Mongolia. Almost all the parameters of this agreement have been confirmed. It will bring 50 billion cubic metres of gas, stable supplies of gas from Russia. President Xi described China as impartial on the war in Ukraine, but it might not look that way to an outsider. President Putin gets 2 days of talks in Moscow and an invite for a return visit to China. President Zelensky is still waiting for a phone call. While President Xi met with a man he calls his dear friend, another world leader visited the site of one of the worst atrocities carried out by Putin's troops in Ukraine. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida laid a wreath and paid tribute to the dead in Bucha, where over 400 civilians are thought to have been killed by Russian forces. I step on the ground of Bucha today. I really feel great anger for all the atrocious acts. I would like to give my heartfelt condolences to all the victims and the wounded on behalf of the Japanese nation. It's clear from the talks in Moscow that Russia needs economic help from China. President Putin said he's ready to help Chinese businesses replace Western firms that have already left the country, and that he could help meet China's growing demand for energy. Vladimir Milov is a former deputy energy minister under Putin who became an economic advisor to opposition politician Alexei Navalny. He's told AM that sanctions are starting to bite in his home country.
Basically, there are multiple indicators which show that a contraction of economic activity is pretty severe, like 5 to 10% year on year, roughly, that's a lot. And the situation is not really getting any better. So if you have this deep cross-sectoral look, you'll see problems which are multiplying over time. And on top of that, you see a very deep budget crisis of this year, plunging oil and gas revenue and growing expenses to finance the war and everything, which is only going to deepen.
It's clear that Russia is becoming increasingly dependent on China and that in any agreement on trade and economic cooperation, Russia will have to deal with being the junior partner. This is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
More stories are emerging about the narrow escape some Australian startups have had after the second biggest bank failure in US history. Tech companies have been customers of Silicon Valley Bank, which collapsed last week, as Nassim Kadem reports.
When startup founder Lauren Humphrey first got word that Silicon Valley Bank was in dire trouble, she panicked.
The advice was going from, hey, get maybe some money out, to like, get it all out. Don't be a company that loses its money.
The Sydney businesswoman runs a company called The Mintable, a platform providing training tools for managers. It had recently raised $6.8 million and roughly 80% of it was sitting in Silicon Valley Bank.
And so I think over the course of an hour, our panic started to rise about kind of the level of seriousness and the probability that the bank was actually going to collapse.
Across the Pacific Ocean in Los Angeles, the founders of another startup, Rory Garton-Smith and Harry Dixon, were also facing uncertainty. The Perth duo moved to the US last year to promote their online shopping app, Checkmate, and Rory Garton-Smith says they'd raised over $7 million, all sitting in an SVB bank account.
Harry and I were in a terrible place, really not sleeping, just in total limbo, wondering what's going on. And then it just became a Twitter frenzy.
While Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, US regulators have stepped in to protect deposits. So both these Aussie startups haven't lost everything. But Andrea Gardiner, who's the founder and CEO of Geelix Ventures, an early stage investor in Australian startups, says it will impact the tech sector.
And investors will want to see the companies with more capital to create more runway to mitigate the risk of running out of capital and dying, in which case everybody loses.
Other big investment banks have stepped in to take SVB's place. Nick Crocker, the general partner at venture capital firm Blackbird Ventures, says that's where startups in his firm's investment portfolio have moved their money.
There's no change to their ability to go and secure funding. There is a change in their ability to have a great relationship with their bank, or at least a great experience with their bank, who might not be as used to banking startups.
Meanwhile, Daniel Ives, who's the managing director at US-based Wedbush Securities, thinks SVB's collapse could send a warning.
I think it just shows how these banks, just how mismanaged they were. And ultimately, there's usually not just one cockroach, there's more than one.
But University of Michigan economics professor Betsy Stevenson says there needs to be a clear distinction between this banking crisis and the global financial crisis 15 years ago.
I think that why I'm not panicked, I don't see this as the GFC 2.0, is I don't see a systemic solvency problem. I hope I keep being right about that.
For now, businesswoman Lauren Humphrey is trying to stay upbeat.
We're just trying to count blessings. Although I will say my co-founder made a great joke, which was that, it's great that they're going to return the money, but like, what about, should we send the therapy bill somewhere? Anyways, we're happy to have our money back and, onwards.
Sydney businesswoman Lauren Humphrey ending that report from Nassim Kadem. Thousands of people in Papua New Guinea may have fallen victim to an apparent online scam which promised them cash if they watched movies and wrote reviews about them. It's called Golden Sun and it's been hugely popular, but now it seems to have collapsed, as Marion Farr reports.
Did no one come to save me just because they missed me? One of the biggest grossing film series of all time, Pirates of the Caribbean, is still popular with movie fans.
But a pirate was free to make his own way in the world.
So when PNG resident Abraham Tamsin was told that he could earn money by watching these movies and others, it sounded like a good idea.
They said, we are going to do a movie review and they will pay us for that movie review.
His cousin sent him a link to a website called Golden Sun. It cost him 700 kina, about 350 Australian dollars, to sign up, and he says he was told all he had to do was watch short clips of blockbuster movies and submit positive reviews to earn points. The out-of-work university graduate was told those points could then be converted into cash. Excited to earn money, he got straight to work.
I spend most of my time, almost 80% to 90% of my daily hours on this.
At first, it all seemed to be going well. Abraham Tamsin submitted reviews and then converted the points he earned, with the money landing in his bank account soon after. But last week, when the 25-year-old tried to make another withdrawal, he ran into trouble.
Everything just went blank. I can't log into my account or even contact the regional managers because their account was deleted on Telegram.
The website has now disappeared, and Mr. Tamsin says he realises that Golden Sun was a scam.
I have lost around 300 plus kina, 360, 70.
Dr. John Cox is an anthropologist and an expert in pyramid schemes in PNG.
People being promised unrealistic returns and with no real explanation of how that money's being generated. So it looks like a pyramid scheme to me.
The operation also caught the attention of PNG's central bank, which said it had become aware that a company calling itself Golden Sun PNG Limited claimed it was set to get a financial trading licence. It said that claim was fraudulent and that the company wasn't authorised to take deposits.
The model is completely unsustainable, and usually after about 6 months or so, when the hype is at its highest, they'll collapse in a greasy heap and the promoters of it will sort of mysteriously disappear.
Golden Sun PNG Limited hasn't responded to the ABC's request for comment, and PNG police haven't responded to our question about whether they're investigating. Dr. Amanda Watson, an expert in digital communication in PNG, says increased internet access is allowing scams to run rampant.
These things can spread fairly rapidly through social media platforms.
As for Abraham Tamsin, he's just trying to put it all behind him.
Yes, I'm angry. I'm angry at the same time. I thought to myself, that was my mistake. I made the choice to go for that. But anyway, I learned from that.
Scam victim Abraham Tamsin, ending that report by Marion Farr. Almost every day we're hearing about how artificial intelligence is changing our lives, and here in Australia it could mean better healthcare in regional areas. A trial of AI technology is assessing whether it can help more people get ultrasounds on their hearts. It could mean cases of heart disease being detected much earlier, something that's vital for vulnerable communities, including Indigenous people. Regional health reporter Stephen Schubert explains.
In a small room in the Alice Springs Hospital, Aboriginal health practitioner Rhonda O'Keefe is doing an ultrasound on a patient's heart, even though she hasn't had any formal training on the equipment.
Started 2 weeks ago and, just in training at the moment, yeah.
Ultrasounds are usually done by a sonographer, someone who's had 2 years of postgraduate study. Instead, Rhonda O'Keefe is being guided by prompts on a screen, telling her to twist the device left or move right.
Very hard in trying to get the best technique, you know, using my arms, my hand to, rotate where the heart is.
It's artificial intelligence which is producing the prompts, and the goal is to make sure Rhonda gets usable pictures during this type of ultrasound, which is known as an echocardiogram. Those pictures are then uploaded to a server, where experienced cardiologists at a remote location can look at them. Dr. Angus Bowman, who's the only permanent cardiologist in Alice Springs, sees it has huge potential.
We don't know how bad the prevalence of heart failure is because we're not able to diagnose everybody because we can't get everybody echo images to have a look at their heart function. We can't diagnose all the rheumatic heart disease because we're not able to get the echoes to confirm they've got it.
Indigenous Australians are three times more likely to die from heart disease compared with non-Indigenous people, and the rate is worse in more remote parts of the country. Professor Tom Marwick from the Melbourne-based Baker Health and Diabetes Institute says the AI trial will also be run in several states, including Walgett in New South Wales, Cherbourg and Cunnamulla in Queensland, and Huonville in Tasmania.
Fundamentally, I don't think it's going to replace a human. I think that it means that the process of interpreting the images will be more consistent and probably more reliable, but it's still going to require some human judgment about what's important and what's not.
Australia has a shortage of sonographers, and the profession has been on the national skills shortage list for more than a decade, according to the Australasian Sonographers Association. CEO Jodie Long agrees there are clear benefits to the AI technology, but cautions against relying too heavily on it.
The role of a sonographer is not about taking the pictures. The role of a sonographer is about performing the scan in real time and being able to see whether something's wrong. The pictures are purely just a representation of what they've seen. So that can be quite challenging for something like AI where it's not reproducible.
For Rhonda O'Keefe, the technology is a game changer, and she's hoping it'll help more Indigenous people get screened for heart issues closer to home.
It's good to help, you know, my people, and sometimes it's hard for them to, you know, get into the hospital. I feel good, yeah. Especially, you know, doing echo training now. Maybe it'll be benefit for my people, you know, out in the communities or wherever they need help.
That's Rhonda O'Keefe, an Alice Springs Aboriginal health practitioner, ending Stephen Schubert's report. It's no secret the high cost of living is affecting many of us, and for pensioners in particular, it's often a juggle between paying rent and putting food on the table. In one regional Western Australian city, the local Meals on Wheels service has seen a 30% increase in demand for pre-cooked meals. From Albany, Brianna Fiore reports.
So this is our chicken and corn soup that's going to go with our roast lamb today.
In the kitchen of a community hall in Albany, Chef Carol Standish is getting ready for the weekly roast day. There'll be about 60 people sitting down for the lunch provided by Meals on Wheels.
A lot of them come here and then they go to bingo, which is held here as well. So they come and have their meal, and if they're a bit slow, we'll dish it up and they'll take it in there with them.
Non-for-profit group Chorus runs the Meals on Wheels service in Albany, and it organises the lunch so that the elderly get to have an affordable dining out experience. Deliveries are still popular too. Carly Russell, who's the customer advocate for Chorus, says demand has risen by almost a third to 200 meals a week in the past 6 months.
A lot of people have said, look, for the cost of what the Meals on Wheels is going to cost me, some of them have used, you know, the expression, it's almost cheaper to have that than to go shopping for myself and buy groceries.
Disability pensioner Graham James is also looking for ways to save money. The 79-year-old retired farmer, who grew up in the wheatbelt town of Dumbleyung before moving to Albany, says his fortnightly pension of $773 doesn't go very far. He and his wife choose carefully when doing their grocery shopping.
They've all gone up a reasonable amount, not as much as you would think when you consider what the farmers get, but we generally use mince quite a lot. That keeps it down, and chicken, that's our main staple.
And he's got some other tips too.
On vegetables, I usually try to have a vegetable garden going, but unfortunately this year has been a bad year because I've had to share it with insects.
Graham James has also dipped into his superannuation to buy solar panels in a bid to lower his power bill. WA's Energy Minister Bill Johnston says he understands the cost of living pressure, but says he doesn't expect the yearly energy bills to rise by more than 2.5% this year.
Well, the good news here in Western Australia is electricity prices are being held down. It's not like on the east coast of Australia, where you're having 30, 40, 50% increases in electricity prices. Our electricity prices have gone up by only 2.5%, and we don't expect that they'll go up by more than that in the future.
Back in the Meals on Wheels kitchen, Chef Carol Standish watches the timer to make sure she doesn't burn the bread and butter pudding.
I've got to go because if I burn the bread and butter pudding, it's going to be ABC's fault and the Aldis will have no dessert and they will not like that.
I bet you they wouldn't. Meals on Wheels chef Carol Standish ending that report from Brianna Fiore. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. He wants to be seen as a peace broker in the Ukraine war. But is that really why the Chinese President Xi Jinping is rubbing shoulders with Vladimir Putin in Moscow? Today, Bates Gill from the Asia Society Policy Institute on China's ambitious plans, whether they should worry Australia. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.